greetings. This is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got a great show tonight. I'm going to skip all the other intros because we had a little technical difficulty in getting on the air. So I'm going to go straight to our guests. We've got Bradley Lockerman on, and we've got John Searle. We're going to start off with Bradley Lockerman, and they just got back from the Tesla Tech Conference. Actually, say that three times real fast. it's quite interesting. I've followed a lot of these movements for quite some time. So without any further ado, let's bring Bradley on the air. Are you with us, Bradley?
You betcha, James. How you doing? Great to be here with you. And, yes, it's Tesla Tech, and that is a little difficult to say.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say we have one more day here. We will be doing tomorrow at 1 o'clock. John will do 2 hours on a very significant piece of hardware that he's brought. So I'm sorry.
Great.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Yeah, now some of the hardware that he's built, I know he's got, could you explain that rather than me butcher it? I don't know if he, I know he's got fuelless energy technology, and I don't know if it's anti- or counter-gravity. And,
beg your pardon. He'll tell you it's inverse gravity.
Okay. And that's a new one for me, but I'll have to study up on that.
No, it's quite fascinating. Just in brief, three rings and three sets of rollers that come from a man and his dreams when he was a child. His dreams were two specific dreams, and they were repeated over 6 years when he was a child. And he had a very brutal childhood, and you can see that in the John Searle story, the film. And it was in 1946, while he was working at British Rewinds in the north of London, that he just came up with a new idea, a different kind of induction of electricity that was based on neodymium and the ability to induce electrons to move through some layered elements using centrifugal forces and magnetic fields. And it's a just a remarkable situation, a remarkable man. He is a living legend, and nowadays mostly referred to as the godfather of free energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the I know the field there. I work with, I don't know if you know him, but his name's, well, they called him Max Langenberg, but Albert is his real name, but he has some very interesting toys, and I worked with him for 7 years, you know, trying to get some of this technology out. So I know what you guys have been up against. He has family threatened and lab blown up and car stolen, and you know, we didn't know if we were going to wake up breathing the next day several times, and luckily
yeah,
I'm not involved in that right now. So.
Well, you know, James, and again, John will tell you this himself in a minute or two, but he's just so wide open about it, and he will say, come in, you don't have to hide behind a bush, come in the front door, come in, have a cup of tea, have a chat, you want to know what we're doing, fine, the doors are open, come on in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we tried that approach in the beginning, but it just didn't seem to work. We found out in the free energy movement, a lot of the people weren't really who they say they are, and the integrity levels weren't there, and a lot of promises were made that weren't fulfilled. And after several demonstrations and all the heat that came out of those demonstrations, you know, he just decided to put it on the shelf and dismantle it and wait, you know, for a later date.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what I found fascinating with the John Searle story is that it is in an area of resonance and frequency. And we find both resonance and frequency within all living things, all stationary things, all moving things. I love these guys that come along, and the anathema in physics is perpetual motion. Well, pardon me, but look at the simple particles running around the nucleus of an atom, and they're called electrons, and I'm sorry, but they are perpetual motion machines. So the fact that matter is as dense as it is, and yet, if you get down to the quantum level, it's not dense at all. There's more space there than there is matter. So why can't you pass your hand through your desk? You know, these are conundrums, I think, that are coming about, but they're coming about, I think, in our day and age, with a set of answers or a set of new possibilities or perhaps a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. I actually know some people that can put their hands through desks and walk through walls and things like that. So to me, it's not that big of a stretch. You know, I've had actually llamas appear in my living room, floating, and then disappear. And I won't go. I can go further into that, but I think this is more about the other technologies.
Yeah, that. My goodness, that would startle me. I think I'd leave the room.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you don't react with fear, you can hang out and learn something. But you know, up here we're having some activity that. Is just insane. We've got probably 1,000 hours of footage of objects flying up there that aren't ours, according to triple PhD Boeing engineers and Lockheed engineers and Skunk Works people that have been out here. And you know, it's a nightly thing. We pull up our lawn chairs and we sit out and watch UFOs, you know, flying around Mount Adams.
Wow. Well, that's fascinating. You know, again, back to John in the 50s and the 60s, there were occasions, I hope we're able to ask him about Warminster or about in any particular period in his life when he was flying them regularly on a come-and-see show type situation where folks were seeing all kinds of UFOs in the Warminster area. Turns out that how many of these were the craft that John Searle was flying off Crookham Hill nearby?
Yeah, that's you never know nowadays. These we had these Lockheed and Skunk Works people looking at it, and they said, you know, these are massive, massive ships. Some are miles wide, and they're, you know, morphing from one to three and back to one again, and just doing crazy things that, you know, stopping, making right angle turns, you know, powering up, lighting up the whole sky. And we've got hours of footage of this with, you know, one of the things that just happened, we had a conference up here with over 300 people attended this conference, and we just got out of one of the events, and this beautiful reddish-pink UFO flew right over the top of the conference building with everybody, you know, standing outside. And a Lockheed engineer actually filmed it, and a geophysicist filmed it, and then a Latin American UFO researcher were all there. They all filmed it with over 200 witnesses.
My goodness. Yeah, but, you know, it's fascinating, and the unexplained are as fascinating as anything, and my experience is that the explained situation is even more fascinating. And, you know, when I met John Searle back in 1994, we were at the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, and he stepped up to me and told me a story. And I, you know, my jaw hit the ground, my eyebrows went back on the top of my head. I just could not believe what I heard. 35 minutes of the most fantastic, off-the-wall, mind-bender thing I'd ever heard. And there it is. And here's this little fellow with bright sky blue eyes and all the energy of a human being that could have and this beautiful smile. And he told me this story, and all I could say was, "You're a movie." And then I went, "Oh, my God." That's the wildest story I ever heard. This is a real thing sitting in front of me. This isn't, you know, something come out and look or look at a piece of footage or anything else. The man is standing in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started to look into it, that became more fascinating than anything I'd ever seen in any particular situation. And, of course, it's come nearly full cycle now to this event down here and, of course, the event in Leeds next week, or I think it's in 2 weeks, where he'll be speaking in front of a very academic crowd at Leeds University and, again, addressing the same thing. You know, John, tell us about the SEG, the Searle Effect Generator. Tell us about how it works and how it behaves under certain conditions, and how can this benefit mankind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be quite awesome. We had Walter Rosenthal with us, and you know, he's known as the Rocket Man, you know, with NASA and everything, and he looked at some of the devices this other guy worked with, and he gave it to him. He said, "Look, you can sit in my lab, you can look at it, you can take it apart, put it back together, run it, did everything," and he said, "If you can figure out how it works, you can have it." And he never did. Yeah, here's a couple, you know, NASA guys and scientists, and they could not figure out how this thing worked. And it not only put out an enormous amount of energy, usable energy, it also took off. You know, if you didn't have a governor on it and slow the rotation down on it, you know, it was ice cold. And it would take off, and actually broke his arm once going through the roof. He tried to grab it and lost one of them, you know.
With a couple of twists and turns, this is nearly the John Searle story from 1946. In fact, you know, why don't we bring him in here and have him tell you? I'll give you a little context. It's post-World War II England, 1946, and John has basically been raised as an orphan. It was very difficult for him when he was young, and Dr. Bernardo's Holmes had put him in foster homes from place to place. But after he left the naval school, did his naval training, he's 14 years old, and he's placed at British Rewinds. Now, that's a company in North London that basically rebuilds generators. So he's working with magnets and coils and rewinding and winding and refurbishing. And he comes up with a new idea. And maybe we can bring him in here now, James, and he can tell you about his experience with his landlady.
That sounds great. I'd love to hear the story.
Hello, James.
Welcome to the show.
Sorry.
No, I'm saying welcome to the show. I can't say enough how much I admire your work and your courage in fulfilling, you know, this destiny you've chosen. And I'm just totally amazed at some of these new technologies you put together.
I think if you was on the Sunday afternoon show, I think you would be amazed, absolutely amazed, that a school boy could put together such a project and get people to actually produce it for him at no cost to him, hardly any cost. All he had to do is tell them how to do it, and they did it. And people who said he could have done it because he didn't have the money. That's right, I didn't have the money. But then, you see, when I worked, they were interested to see if I could be shut up, or whether I should leave the company because I won't shut up. So they actually gave me the opportunity to prove that it could be done. Unfortunately, just at that period, nuclear power was coming online, and the area in the Midlands, some streets had 240 volts AC, some had 110 DC, some had even only 100 DC, and it was just chaos. No good for atomic power. So we had to go through every house, make a list of every electrical component, and it was my task to make sure they were converted to run on 240 volts AC. And that was quite an experience to check washing machine, cookers, and radios and things like that. But it was a good practice for me. And how it started was really when I was put into Dick's accommodation, and we had a Welsh landlady, and her name was Trigoning, and she was quite a, shall we say, playful person. She would get me into a lot of trouble, the milkman and that. But let's look at the other side of her. She was so excited, holding the wires for me to solder it on. And she would then say, and I'd say, "Twit, you sure it won't blow the fuses?" "No, it won't blow." This went bang, and the head jumped up to the ceiling. And I thought you said it won't explode. I said, well, it shouldn't have done. We have to find out why. But then I got to a point, I was trying to test this Dream 1 and Dream 2 configuration. And I made what was supposed to be, I had hoped, a power generator to light the lights and to power the small cooker. And, of course, there's no books on the market saying that if you do this, you'll find a hole in your ceiling. On the first attempt, of course, it went to the ceiling. And, of course, that was a job to get down. The question was, what do I do now? Trying to say it won't take off the table. The silly thing did. And now I put a lump of lead on the bottom saying that that would certainly hold it down. I'm sorry, I was wrong. It didn't hold it down. The stupid thing went to the ceiling. And I said to the landlady, look at that stupid thing. I said, I tried to stop it from going there. You'd have to get the step ladders and put a large screwdriver so I could pull it down. And when I got hold of it to pull it down, boy, that was cold. My hand sort of stuck on the handle, its edge. I managed to pull it down. The landlady got warm water and poured on my hands to free it. Now, I had no idea why it was so cold. There was nothing on the market in book form, and here I am, stuck with a problem. In the end, I said to myself, if it wants to be stupid enough to fly, let's give it a body. So I made up a body for it, and when we went out with it, we were surprised that it went up, well, quite a few yards, as I picture it, above the roof. It glowed. And in those days, we only had long radio. So that meant we had this long copper wire from the radio right down the yard to the pole to pick up the radio station. And, of course, that was a silly thing to be there, because when it hovered, eventually the glowing came, and then the energy went on all these wires. And, of course, it wasn't right, because everyone's radio blasted out, and they couldn't turn it off. And I said, so I became unpopular. But what happened was that the one that put it through the ceiling meant that I had to have temporary accommodation by the king's pleasure. And, of course, the poor landlady had to go to bedsit. Unfortunately, I never saw her again after that. Mm. But while I was in this, what we say, special care, where you have to chamber the bed because they lock the door so you won't get hurt.
They put you in jail, John. Why don't you just say it?
Well, it was the policeman's house.
You wrecked his house. Yeah.
And after a few days, they provided me another accommodation, but they made sure the person locked me in the room so I wouldn't do anything that would improve the ventilation as I did to 30 Crawley Road.
Blowing holes through roofs.
But I built up equipment, and we find that it took my legal papers of my document out of homes. It said that the person had to make a number of trips. There was so much equipment he had accumulated to move it to the new site. But at the new site, I had to find a job suitable. And the landlady had already asked me if I'd like to work in the camera shop. Son had to enter the Air Force, which was a three-year period. And then we had this trouble that the boss of the camera shop was short of assistance. So she said, well, I'll take you to meet him and we'll see if he's prepared to take you on. Now, I'd like to point out here, Dr. Murnado's homes in those days were kin and master of all things. And they set you in a job, they set you in accommodation. You must not move from that job or the accommodation without their consent and approval. And, of course, being a teen boy that wants to learn things, he forgot about the rules. And, of course, he went to the chemist shop and it was this other house. The homes had no knowledge of. All they know that the checks are sent to assist my the care to look after me, but what's returned? No one available at the house, so they didn't know where I was. At the, I worked at this chemist shop in 4 weeks. The chemist said to me, John, I will give you the keys to the shop, be on time, open it up, and I'll be in by 10 o'clock. If you have any trouble with a prescription that the man wanted in a hurry, if you're not sure, just ring me and tell me exactly what you do, and I will say okay. I never did have to call him. But lots of strange things I did there, which are very funny, but at the moment, those things don't help the project. But what did happen, the boss one day came to me and said, John, look, you deserve more money than I can give you. What would you like if you, I get you a job in a hospital and you have better money? So I agreed. I went down to the hospital. They gave me some checks and they said, okay, we'll give you a month's trial. And that led on to something else. Now, the thing is, from there, I move on, and I went to another area, which also brought me in contact with the Minister's Electricity Board. There, they have big generators being constructed, big magnetizers to magnetize the project. After that, we got to a point where I kept talking about the work, and in the end, the boss could see people were laughing, and he came in and he said, John, you have three options. Pack your bags and go. Two, shut up. Three, do it. So I said to him, afraid I like my job and I don't want to go. Secondly, I can't shut up. It's suddenly driving me mad. But I am prepared to do it. So he said, right, what do you want? I thought, well, we got everything except the rare earth. Now, we get it for you. You have to pay for that. We can make an HP agreement for payment. So had they got the kilo. Now, bear in mind, in that time period, 1 kilo of rare earth cost only 32 cents per kilo. Now, you can't get that for that price today. Now, they had all the other things, copper and stuff like that. They had Bakelite as the insulating material we need. So all I had to do was draw up what I wanted done. And there, well, 30-year-old experts on magnetism and that, they got this old magnetizer, stripped it down, and then tried to set it up. Now, of course, everybody was hoping it wouldn't work, because then the laugh would be really great. But they did, they toured with it, and in the end, they got a layer segment. It was a pudding mixture. And what we did with that was to try to get them to energize it in a particular way. And they worked at this and they got it. One of the four of us that was controlling 11 areas actually worked the calculation for the AC coil. No one has ever used AC in magnetic work. And of course, it looks like that was not going to work. But they did what I said. And I don't know if they made more than one try, but they did bring me this segment. I looked at it, and I was happy. I was, okay, go ahead and make me few. I want 8 for a roller set, and I want a plate made this size. And yes, eventually we got it. And lo and behold, it ran around the plate, you know, that proved the job. But then, you see, the question was, the electric board had agreed to good nuclear power. So this device didn't interest them. No, it was really exciting, but for production, they already committed.
What kind of voltage were you getting, John?
They got 210 out of it. It didn't quite make the 230 then, yeah. But because the trouble was, I had to learn what was going on with the system. And
what year was that?
That was 1944, Put system. That was the end of 47.
So you had a new type of generator that was giving that kind of output without any input whatsoever.
Yeah, there was no input by itself.
Spinning magnets going around itself. Midland's electric board permitted you to do this, in fact, challenged you to do this. You did it for them. It was doing this kind of output. And what was the reaction of everybody around?
Well, of course, they were amazed. To them, it looked like some novelty, some toy, a very heavy one, I must admit. But to them, it's a toy. To see a roller running around a plate, who ever seen that? Nobody's seen a roller run around a plate on its own with no power input. So it was a joy. A toy that excited people, but they could not see that making an electrical house. So that was an incident. Any case, they were committed. Amen. Now, from there on, it was a question to do some experiments. And of course, the workshop was a research station where we test to find faults in materials, and we could give them long-run testing. So everything was in the right place. All I had to do is find out why and what would happen. And, of course, I tried to use my early... I made coils around it and thought, right, this is it. I'll strap on some wires. Now, I went to solder the wires on. The iron was red hot. But as I approached it, it went dead cold. I could hold the tip. Yet it was still plugged on the mains, heating it. So I thought there must be something wrong with this iron. So I unplugged it, got another one from the store, plugged it in, nice and hot, went to fix that wire, and that tube was flat.
So why weren't you able to solder? It kept getting cold.
Well,
because of the machine.
Eventually I realized what was happening. The iron tip was losing electrons to the air, and getting hotter and hotter because of this action.
Where were the electrons going?
They just go into the room, just go there, you know, mixed up with the airflow and everything else. What we found out was at what we must be doing, if I was losing electrons, I knew I was losing electrons from the tip bit. That's why you have to replace them every so often, because they're too worn out. The question must be, the reverse was happening. Electrons was going into the iron and cooling it. The more that went in, the cooler it got. And it never took long for enough electrons to knock that cold, so you couldn't solder it.
So those were electrons that were literally pumping out of the device that you had built.
Yes.
And they were pumping out at such a fantastic rate that they were cooling an intensely hot soldering iron, taking it right down to a temperature you could touch with your finger.
Yes.
So what do you?
I could hold it.
So was this device that you'd invented? Was it a superconductor? What was going on with it?
Well, that was a problem. I had to get it finished. That was only the first test, so that was okay. So I'd see the rollers running around. I'd see that the iron don't work when you approach it. So I accept that electrons was more than they were losing that went cold. So we solved one problem. So we make the next ring, because they now know what to do, and then rollers again, and the third one, and then we put coils around. Now the question now was, here was something never done before. There's no books, the electric board didn't really know what the hell I was doing. It's just a lump of heavy metal, some heavy rollers running around this plate.
And yet they let you do it. They did,
because I had the option. Get out, shut up, or do it.
And once you had done it, they kind of backed off and said, well, this is interesting, let's see what happens.
Yeah, and that's it. And what we found out was that here, the way I was making the material up was a solid rod. But when we first tried, it twisted. So I thought to myself, how do you overcome this? And the dream would say eight. So I divided it into eight parts, then magnetized each section and put it on. Now it was running true around that ring. And it was off the bottom, and it was actually in the center running. Here we had something that one would expect would fall off. But From there, we just completed the whole unit. And that set the electric board for quite a few months. We didn't do nothing else with it. This roller just kept running round and round, and nothing changed. But it only the fact that it was always cold in that area. But from then on, I thought, well, the first ones were taken off. And we put it on the body and tried to see what happens. So I had to get an outside party to get those rollers moving. Once they were moving, that was it, really fast. I disconnected the power unit, and then it was an amazing thing. I thought, well, we're going to have some electric now. But it was more amazing because it went up in the air, up just above the trees, and it hovered there. Now, we're talking about certainly about 3 to 4 kilos in weight. There it is up there, and suddenly it starts to glow colours. And, of course, we couldn't hear it. We were out away from radio set, so I didn't know if they were. But then suddenly, the amazing thing is, shot up. And now it shot up upwards. And as far as we know, it kept on going in that direction because even Sir Isaac Newton understood that if a force is applied to something, it continued in that straight line.
Okay, John, let's do this one more time slowly for James and his wonderful audience. You kickstart this device with an outside power source.
Yes.
When the rollers achieve a certain speed, they don't need any more of the outside power source, and it kicks off a switch. So now it's running on its own. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so as it's running on its own, what is it? It is speeding up?
Yes.
Okay, it's speeding up. Now, as it speeds up, there's this field that we were talking about before. The electrons are literally pouring out of this thing, correct?
That's correct.
Now, when they get to a place that, let's call it an overload, then what happens? You're saying to us that it lifts?
It lifts. It actually at speed.
Lifts at speed.
Yes.
Now, this is roughly what diameter? It's a disc, am I correct?
Yes, yes.
And what diameter is this disc?
The diameter of that particular one was 12 inches. So we had sunny 12 inches, and it weighed 32 cents, a kilo in weight. Now we got to think if we got a roller weighing about 8 ounces, and it's sticking on there, and once I let go, it lifts off the roller with plate, and it then spins around this whole thing, and the roller itself is spinning. Now, when I talked to some experts about what to do, they said, impossible, impossible. And they wouldn't even come and look at it.
Yes, well, it sounds impossible because you're telling us that this disc-shaped generator overloads to a certain point and then lifts off. And you say when it lifted off, it goes to a certain height,
yeah.
And then sits there and hovers for a bit. Now, what happens when it's sitting there in this hover thing? What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing the glow gradually building up.
Okay, the glow. Now, we're to assume that it's so filled with electrons that it looks electric. Is it making a noise? Is it...
Well, there's no noise.
No noise.
No.
But you're seeing a color change. What colors are you seeing?
Well, you're going through... you don't get white, but you do get green and blue, depending how much voltage is raised before you earth it. Earthing it is when you're discharging it. Now, what we never expected was that it would suddenly shoot off. We just thought it would hang down and come back to Earth.
So it goes up.
Yeah.
So it hovers up, there. Up. What period of time are you watching it hover and change color?
We're looking about 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Yeah.
And now, do you think it's continuing to charge up higher and higher and higher and higher?
Yeah, higher and higher.
So you don't have any control over this charge.
No.
It's just going wild.
This is
it. And then it gets to a place where gravity is no longer able to hold it or some effect is happening, and then suddenly it shoots off. What rate of speed are you watching this shoot-off action? Can you estimate how fast it shoots up?
Well, let's say you're looking at it for about 3 minutes while it's hovering, and then within a minute and a half, 2 minutes, it's out of sight.
Gone.
It's completely out of sight.
And now, I remember when we were first in London together, and I asked you, where did it go, and you just pointed up. Now, that means you don't know where it went, but it went that away.
That away, yes.
And as far as you know, it's still going.
Well, Sir Isaac Newton made it clear that when something moves by force, it continues in that straight line. Now, so it's going to go. Now, to change that, you've got to apply a force to change it. But I can't fly, so I can't go up and stick a force on it to turn it.
Right.
So it will keep going.
It's still going.
And as far as I'm concerned, no one in the world ever contacted me to say, have you lost a big lump green material with a roller-type object bouncing around it?
So it's still out there. What year did this one launch?
Well, which main one there when we were talking about here, late, what was it, 48, towards the end of 1948.
Okay, and then you had George Haynes come into your life, and there were six more that were launched and
yes.
Lost.
What happened is this poor man was dying of cancer, but he was highly religious, and he listened to the Pope's message at night at 8 o'clock. I would go out to be polite. I would sit by him, and when this verse, Bible stuff was finished, he turned to me and said, John, what's your interest? So I told him about this thing. John, if you can make people look up, I will pay the price of the cost to do it, because everyone is looking down at the ground. Okay, so he called his son and said, take John on Wednesday to the big market, get everything he needs. So they did this, and of course the shed was built, I built what the unit, and of course I thought, now I've got time to see, I may solve the problem. So I did. Now, the thing was, I wasn't fitting it anywhere. I was wondering if it would stay there. So I just give it the usual spin up, and then take the line away, and it started going. And then it shot up above the house, and it started going. But then was the most horrid part, because it was discharging such vast energy, spreading out everywhere, hitting these copper wires from the radio down to the back of the garden. And boy, that was a din of
so
a noise.
That's excuse me. That's when you're telling us about the old long wave radio in World War II period, when everybody had a giant aerial running down their fence posts.
Yes.
So the electrons, this superconductor energy, was so intense that it traveled on these copper wires into the radio sets and immediately flipped them on, whether you turned them on or not.
Yeah.
So all the radio stations in the area where you were fiddling around with this, we're all coming on and making a tremendous racket.
Yes.
And how did the people around there react? They obviously knew about Searle, what he was doing. They were watching you, correct?
Yeah. But now they were looking at the sky.
So they were watching it.
They were watching it lift off.
They saw these colors.
And then everything went quiet. So I went up to George Haynes and said, I'm sorry, I've lost it. Did they look up? Good God, they sure did.
And so this man who is ill with cancer, all he wants to do is make people look up.
That's it.
And he sees in your idea an opportunity to amaze people and get people to lift their heads to the heavens.
Yeah.
That's his whole
religion,
notion.
Yes. God and the heavens.
Oh, isn't that marvelous?
And yeah, so I've got a question.
I've
got a quick question for you.
Yep.
Do you have any idea what the RPM on that is when it's spinning?
That's a very good question, John. When it's activated and it's up in its first hover position, what do you estimate the RPM of the rollers, the inner and outer rollers? How fast are they spinning?
I would expect from nature test about 25,000 revs per minute.
25,000 RPM.
Yeah.
Now, is that the inner set
inner,
of rollers?
Yes. Yeah.
So the outer set of rollers would be at?
The middle set is 2.5 times the speed if we at sides.
Okay, 25,000 revs per minute on the inner set.
Yeah.
Two times that number on the middle set.
Yeah. And on the final one, it's another two times.
Another two times the center for the outer one.
Yeah.
So this is tremendous activity.
Though there are rollers, individual rollers, scientists always in their reports said you've got a solid ring spinning around because they couldn't see.
They were moving. Understood. They were moving so fast they looked as if they were solid.
Solid, yeah.
That's astounding. Now, you had these first six. George Haynes paid for them. Now, he passes away, and then you start to explore how to control them. Is that correct?
That's correct. I couldn't do very much for the next few years until 1956. In 1956, I then had the first lot of money come in from old age pensioners. Eventually, I had 13 of them putting money in. But
so,
they made a condition. Do not go commercial. We don't want any bother with the taxman.
So what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1956.
Okay, in 1956-57, 13 old-age pensioners. Those are guys who are basically retired, and they have a little money, and they're familiar with this man, Searle, who's doing these astounding experiments with a new type of generator device that is literally lifting off, and they just get together and say, hey, what a great idea. Let's give this guy some money and see what he can really do. Is that the condition that was happening?
Yes, yes.
And so you were afforded, through this investment, the opportunity to explore this idea that you both came up with from your dreams and were able to bring forth into a reality that everyone saw.
The thing was that they only want a bit of fun, that old age people, with nothing to do. If Searle could put something up there that frightens people, that would be fantastic. Long as he did not tell people that he was the one doing it.
Well,
the records show I was very successful at frightening people.
Now let's get into that. Now, apparently at one point you learned to control these. Now, let's tell James and his audience how big. How many discs did you build?
Well, when we had to pack up completely, there was 41 discs built.
41.
Number one was the 41st disc.
41 flight vehicles. Now, these were, over the years, you had learned how to control them. Is that correct?
Right, yes.
And you learned to control them through an ability that we understand you sent signals to the craft using ham-operated radio. Is that correct?
Yes. We couldn't use what we call radio aircraft model type because the object moved too fast and would run out the range that these portable things would do.
So you had to have the higher frequencies
yes.
of the ham
yes.
operations,
yes.
and it had to pass in front because it was
yes.
moving so fast.
Yes.
Now, tell us about, you sent a signal. What happened to that signal? It went to the craft and did what?
Well, what it goes through is an encoder, decoder circuit, and that would do, I would turn the flight sail to change the angle flight so that it'd take a new path. Now, to do that, I couldn't do that part from my house. To send it out a long distance, you do have to have ham operator. They have to have the same equipment as you got, so that they are doing precisely what you're doing. Except with it.
So you had a series of friends that were also ham operators that you spoke to prior to flights and said, we want to fly it on this particular pattern. Will you be ready? And at this particular time, these are the signals I want you to send to the craft. And is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, how far away? You would be based basically in the Mortimer area,
yes.
correct? And now, say you were going to Cornwall. Did you have somebody stationed in Cornwall?
The Air Force people wanted to check whether this model, which I was claiming speeds, was real. So what they did, they came to me and said, look, we're going to get two helicopters. We're going to fit a boom with cameras, which Germany are making for us. We're going to hire two pilots at £60 per hour. to film the whole thing.
Okay, before you go on now, we're talking about two helicopters. In what year are we now?
But looking at 1965.
Okay, in 65, the mid-60s, two helicopters. Now, this event where you're going to actually try to measure both the speed and get photographs and get a lot of data based on a particular flight that you're trying to set up. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay, now go on. Two helicopters, and what happened?
Well, we set the date to go, and the beauty about this, remember, I'm in the back shed at the house you filmed in Mortimer.
That's in the film. We can see that in the John Searle story.
And
okay.
I'm operating it from there. And when they told me they were ready, I could start. And I said, well, let me know when it reached 15 miles high. 3 minutes later, they would say, yeah, you can turn, you can turn. So I switched it to go to Cornwall, where another unit's waiting. So 3 minutes later, they were ringing me again. Turn it back. You passed the point.
Okay, let's stop here, because this is amazing. Now, from Mortimer at your home, 3 minutes it takes to go 15 miles high?
Yep.
3 minutes, 15 miles of climb.
Yep.
And then 3 more minutes from 15 miles directly overhead over to Cornwall, which is roughly how far away from where you are?
200-odd miles away.
200-odd miles, and it's traveling 200-odd miles in 3 minutes. And this must have been astounding to you, was it not?
To me, I knew it went fast.
You knew it went fast.
It was a shock to the film people who expected to see something slowly move and slow it down.
So it wasn't slow at all. It literally launched at a high rate in 3 minutes. It's at 15 miles. Now, where are these helicopters? Did they recover any data?
No. Well, they were expecting something coming up slow.
Right.
They missed it.
Oh, so they were aiming and thinking, you know, rocket, slow launch, and then it's going to go faster. This thing just leaps into the air and then continues to accelerate.
Well, I bet you see the color photo. You see that the air, the force, it ripples up down from the ground. Things in the background look like they're just flying apart.
That's correct. Yeah. We do see that in the John Searle story. That's the one photo of the disc rising and that diffused that's actually a tower that
behind
is diffused
it,
because of the violence of this launch.
Yeah. The air is moving, causing the pilot in the way in the background to fly apart.
And so those photos are from this event that you're talking about.
Yes.
Fascinating. Now, it's up in 3 minutes. It's over in 3 minutes. Where does it go from there? Did you
back
bring it back?
Back to the site.
You brought it back.
Yes.
And then brought it back down.
And now, the problem was, the pilots they paid here £60 on each of them, £60
the helicopter.
Per hour, for their time. Had no time to capture the pitch, the flight pitch. Now, I'd warn BBC, that would be the case. But they didn't believe me.
So now that's interesting. You mentioned BBC. Now this is part of the news. You are basically talked about on a regular basis by the BBC, by ITV, by magazines, by newspapers. They're coming to interview Searle. I understand they're coming to see the Demo 1. Tell about the Demo 1.
Well, what happened was, I proposed to 400 scientists at a meeting on a Sunday in Mortimer, St. John's Hall, about my idea of a manned flight craft. They said that that's a split-beam system. It would never fly. It would not even support itself.
Well, hold on there. You said manned craft. Now you're talking in the mid '60s to the '70s. Now you're thinking about getting in this thing and flying somewhere.
Yep. Yes.
And it would simply require a pressurized cabin, apparently.
Yes.
So you're going to actually get in it and go with these outrageous people. Well, what would happen to you if you got in one and took off at that rate?
Well, what has happened was that a number of flight tests, Mueller has sent sensors the engine didn't pick them in. That was to measure the loading of the structure.
Oh, I see. So in your models, you were putting instruments inside to measure the activity should you be in it at one time. So you planned all along to get aboard and go somewhere.
Oh, yes. There was no question about it. The press could see clearly. Well, even the doctor came in and said, "That's you in spacework." Oh, no. No, we're just going to do radio TV repairs. And went away. Then the midwife came. And the first thing she said, you're in spacework. Oh, no, we're doing radio repairs. And when the news hit the paper, they came, we knew that was space work that you were doing. You know, we didn't really believe that was radio and television because it looked so much like NASA.
And that's all that equipment and all the all the stuff that.
Yeah.
Now, how was it okay with the authorities that you had? Some of this stuff must have been illegal to have, wasn't it?
Well, oh yes. We used the transmitter was 1154, and everyone had to use the same one.
1154. Yeah. Now that what is it? Cycles per second?
Or? 1,400 cycles.
Now
per
this
second.
Is the radio beam that you needed to stay ahead of the speed of the craft.
Yeah. Again, it was a cheap project to buy.
Right.
Now the receiver was the R1145. Now that I set on top, so you could hear the signals that was coming back from it. So you knew that it was still operating when you sent it off on a run. The people that would see it first. They will also now begin to pick up the signal,
mm-hmm.
which they've been told to listen for.
Well, that brings a story to mind in the film. Now, you mentioned something about Blackbush Airport, that apparently you parked a craft in the sky, that it was hovering there for a period of time, and because of its intense emissions, it was messing with the radio traffic of incoming and outgoing aircraft. Is this true?
But, yes. One of my craft landed up at Blackbush area.
Well,
the
now
airport.
Wait, you said landed. Was it actually
not landed? No. When I say landed, I mean it arrived at that point, and it shouldn't have been there.
Well, what arrived? Now, arrived where? Where was it?
Well, it was supposed to be going through Eastleigh and around and come back through Mortimer area.
Right.
And then on again back through the White Island of White. And down to Portugal,
right.
And that, where hams were waiting.
So you
somebody put the wrong signal out.
So you had a flight pattern error, and it ended up. Now, what we're talking about is parked in the sky.
Yes, it was. What happened is I got a phone call. Can you please remove your craft because it's interfering with radio communication?
Who called you?
At the airport, the air tower.
And they knew to call you.
Yeah, they called me, just asked me to remove it, and because it's stopping communication to aircraft landing.
But so they knew it was a Searle disc.
Oh yes, because they had seen pictures that I had posted around, so they knew right away and they saw it was Searle. Then they said to me, "Are we going to inform the press about it?" So good, fair enough. Then the press came on to me about an hour later. Is it true that Blackbush rung you up to move your craft? I said, yes. And what happened? I said, it's been moved now. I've been intercepted and moved it. Oh, well, that'll be in tomorrow's paper. So I got all the papers and I was shocked. It said, UFO over Blackbush Airport. Interfere with incoming radio signals from landing aircraft.
Wait a minute. It said UFO?
Yeah.
Why did they not say Searle disk or
but,
UFO?
Well, the airport told them, the press reported.
They didn't know what
it was.
Then
the press reported obviously were told not to mention Searle craft. A UFO.
But this wasn't a UFO at all.
No.
This was a Searle disk. In what year?
1957.
Bradley and John, and you know, we're running up the hour here. We've gone a little bit over, and so you know, we've got to cut it off. Unfortunately, this is just an amazing interview, and it's such a mind-blower to know this technology has been out for that long and hasn't come out, you know, for the good of the people. So,
well, great, James. We'll let you wrap it up.
Yeah, so basically, what is the best way to get a hold of that DVD, and how can people learn more about the story?
Oh, goodness, thejohnsearlstory.com. Very simple, johnsearlstory.com. And for further information, I suggest the searleffect.com, searleffect, searleffect.com. That's our wonderful John A. Thomas in Rochester. You can look at Searle Solution, searlsolution.com. And, of course, Swallow Command, the wonderful Swallow Command, SWALLOW command.com. And,
I wish you all the luck in the world in continuing and getting this information and this technology out. And again, John, I can't thank you enough for your work as well. Keep up the awesome work, and hopefully we'll get you back on the air again real soon.
Thank you, James.
All right, have a good evening.
Bye now.
Bye.
All right, boy, I wish I could have gone longer, but we're out of time. An amazing story, and you know where to get the rest of the story. So this is James Gunn with As You Wish Talk Radio, signing off. Have a great evening. Good night.